Well, he announced it himself. Jean-Guy Quiras played the saraband from Bach's solo cello suite number 2. Amazing the intimacy that this hall can take. You know, it's completely full tonight. Everywhere I look, people coloured in, people wearing t-shirts, shirts. The whole of London humanity is here, you know, and there's just that sense of focus on the tiny, relatively small sounds that a solo cello makes. 6,000 sets of ears completely focused on that performance, as I'm sure you were too at home. Jean-Guyen Quiras accepting applause from the audience here on his own now, and warm applause too from the orchestra, especially the cello section, I note. Well, that brings us to interval time tonight, and now it's time to join Rana Mitter for tonight's Proms Plus Literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello, and welcome to tonight's Proms Plus Literary event. We've just heard the wonderful Dvorak Cello Concerto in B minor. And of course, in the repertoire, the cello strings have provided rosin-laden inspiration for everyone from Elgar to Shostakovich. But it's not so obvious that the cello also has a second life on the printed page. One recent work of fiction, Stephen Galloway's novel The Cellist of Sarajevo, drew on the Balkan Wars of the 1990s to tell the tale of a musician who played his instrument in the besieged city in the face of deadly sniper fire from the nearby hills. But there was something particularly poignant about the instrument that he chose. Even more than the trumpet or the violin, there's something about the low, noble notes of the cello that seems to speak to the poignancy and fragility of human existence. But why have writers chosen to bring this particular instrument into their narratives? Well, to answer this question, I'm delighted to be joined by a critic with many strings to her bow. Peggy Reynolds teaches at Queen Mary, University of London, and is a regular broadcaster on arts and music. And also with us are the cellist Charles Martin to give us musical illustrations, along with the pianist Helen Crayford. Please welcome them all. Now, Peggy, I'd actually like to start with a rather unlikely pairing, because Shakespeare and the cello don't really go together in most of our minds, but maybe we ought to be thinking again.
Well, this came out of something where I began to think, well, where would I find the earliest cello? And of course, really and truly, the cello repertoire doesn't come into being until much later on. But I looked at Shakespeare thinking, well, where is there lots of music in Shakespeare? And of course the answer was Twelfth Night. It begins, after all, with, if music be the food of love, play on. But then, when I looked again, I realized that in Act 1, Scene 3, you have this very interesting moment when Sir Toby Belch, who you will all remember, is the roistering knight, the uncle of Olivia, who's mourning her dead brother and cloistered herself up. And he's introduced into the household one Sir Andrew Aguecheek, who he has a fancy should marry his niece. She's not interested, I have to say. And the servant, Maria, says to Sir Toby, why have you introduced this dreadful man at this particular moment? And he answers her, he's as tall as any man in Deliria. And I thought, Maria says, what's that to the purpose? But of course, we're not talking about height here. Because then it goes on. He plays the viol de gamboys. Now, I know the viol de gamboys is not a cello, but it is the forerunner of the modern cello. It's quite different in terms of strings and all that sort of thing. But then I realized that there was a sort of pun in there as well, because, of course, it's the viol de gamboys, because it's gamb, like, you know, leg in Spanish. And in particular, in 16th century slang, it was gam was leg for a was slang for a female leg. And then you get a bit down further, and they start talking about Sir Andrew's hair. And Sir Toby says, it hangs like flax on a distaff, and I hope to see a housewife take thee between her legs and spin it off. And then there's stuff about doing a caper and playing the galliard and showing an excellent leg. And none of this is about music.
I mean, Peggy, let's get absolutely to the point here. When we're talking about taking the instrument, placing it between the legs and so forth, we're talking about something really rather raunchy here, aren't we?
We are. And you've got to remember that Shakespeare was a man who adored his words, his puns, his wordplay, and this is what is going on here.
And Charles, I mean, this is obviously something that is a little bit before the time of the cello that you're showing us there, but You have, I think, got something for us that shows us the kind of music that we might have actually heard in Shakespeare's time. What's the piece of music that you've gone for?
Well, it's a little piece I composed myself, actually. I wanted to give a kind of atmosphere of what it was like in maybe the inns rather than the courts and the country houses. And so if we want a little bit of ribaldry, I focused on the hurdy-gurdy, which is, of course, a stringed instrument which is played by winding a handle, and the strings vibrate on a wheel. And it was a very popular instrument in those times, and it goes right back to, well, the earliest ones go back to the 11th century. But this is how I imagine they would have sounded in one of your roadside inns.
Raunchy and rumbustious that certainly was, I have to say, Charles. And,
yes, you can hear Sir Toby and Sir Andrew getting up to all sorts of things with that, can't you?
Flagons of ale all over the shop, I have to say. But the 19th century is really when the English novel takes off as a genre, and the cello also really begins to come into its own at that particular point. And Peggy, it's Anthony Trollope who brings the two together in his novel The Warden. And I think he uses a particular phrase about the cello. He calls it the most melancholy of instruments.
He does. And as I've been working through the cello, and I was quite surprised to find this major part played by the cello in The Warden, it's become clear to me that people who play the cello are good people. There you are, Charles. They're honest, they're trustworthy, they're sensitive. And this is very much the case in The Warden. The story concerns a reverend gentleman called Septimus Harding, and he is the warden of a group of almshouses. And the charity that pays his money, pays his wage, has done so well that he is getting the grand sum of £800 a year, but spending very little on the men who are living in his almshouse. And somebody decides that this is most improper. It's a kind of 19th century version of politicians' expenses scandal. But the warden himself plays the cello, and he has made a beautiful book of sacred music at vast expense, and this has been his one guilty pleasure. And when he's agitated, interestingly, Trollope portrays him as doing air cello playing with lots of finger work when he's very worked up, and then calming himself down with gentle bowing. But there is one little concert that I thought was very lovely, where he's describing a group of people playing together. Away they go in full flow of harmony together, uphill and down dale, now louder and louder, then lower and lower, now loud as though stirring the battle, then low as though mourning the slain. In all, through all, and above all, is heard the violoncello. Ah, not for those nothing were those pegs so twisted and retwisted. Listen, listen. Now alone, that saddest of instruments tells its touching tale. Silent and in awe stand fiddle, flute, and piano to hear the sorrows of their wailing brother.
So clearly, the 19th century is a period which has, amongst other things, a great interest in folk music. And a particular piece, The Ashgrove, shows how the cello could be used as part of that particular musical trend. Charles?
Yes. Folk music, of course, was a huge thing in the 18th and 19th centuries. And you talked of melancholy. And, well, The Ashgrove is a very melancholy song. It's about the lady whose love lies underneath the soil. And very, very sad. So I thought it was very appropriate to play this piece.
Thank you.
And in the 20th century, that theme of melancholy associated with the cello really does continue. And I'm wondering, Peggy, am I stretching it to say that the cello seems to symbolise the melancholy of the world, or at least the Western world, after the Great War, this wrenching historical event? One example that comes to mind is almost a sort of small section of the novel Goodbye, Mr. Chips, by James Hilton, published in 1934, although, of course, set in a slightly earlier era, and perhaps actually, to be honest, more famous to many people through the film, which starred Robert Donat and Greer Garson.
Yes, unforgettable. I expect lots of people here will remember it. Wonderful film. Quite agree. Yeah. Actually, you're absolutely right, because, of course, even if you look at your programs for tonight, for tonight's concert, you will see that it says that the cello really comes into its own at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century. That's the moment when all the great composers begin to start writing concertos for it. So in a way, James Hilton did know exactly what he was doing here. Well, I hardly need to begin to tell you the story of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. You're absolutely right. It is published in 1934. In fact, it is set a little bit earlier. Mr. Chipping, as he is really and truly, is a kind of mediocre schoolmaster in a public school. And he muddles through his career until this amazing moment. The whole novel is set around the fact that he's dying, he's fading, and he's looking back over his memories. In middle age, he meets this astonishing young woman, Catherine, and marries her. And I'll just read you a little bit of this when he first meets her. She is, I should tell you, a strong-minded woman. She is a new woman. They first meet when she's riding her bicycle and she runs him over in the Lake District. He had never met anyone like her. He had always thought that the modern type, this new woman business, would repel him. And here she was, making him positively look forward to the glimpse of her safety bicycle careering along the lakeside road. And she, too, had never met anyone like him. She had always thought that middle-aged men who read the Times and disapproved of modernity were terrible bores. Yet here he was, claiming her interest and attention for far more than youths of her own age. Within a week, they were head over heels in love. Well, of course, they do get married. And the point of us telling you this story is that Catherine plays the cello. As I say, it's always the really good people who tend to play the cello. So as Chips, because he's always called Mr. Chips by the boys and indeed by Catherine herself, remembers her, this is what it says. And so it stood, a warm and vivid patch in his life, casting a radiance that glowed in a thousand recollections. Catherine, scampering along the stone corridors, laughing beside him at some howler in an essay he was marking. Taking the cello part in a Mozart trio for the school concert, her creamy arm sweeping over the brown sheen of the instrument. She had been a good player and a fine musician.
And it seems to me, Peggy, that, I mean, you've mentioned that the character of Catherine is a new woman, something new and feisty in the late 19th, early 20th century. Is there a connection there between the sort of gendering of the instrument, the fact that men and women perhaps play in different sorts of ways, and the emergence of this new type of female character?
I think undoubtedly there is, because there's something very bold, very striking. I mean, not to say that Charles isn't looking very striking here, but you know, to have a woman taking this instrument, which is, of course, in the shape, you know, effectively of a woman's body with its curves and all the rest of it. So the doubling of the idea of the woman's body, Charles is demonstrating for the audience, and the instrument is something that very much comes into that. And I think also the showiness of the cello is something that makes it appropriate, not just for a woman in general, but for a woman like Catherine, who wants to take the world by storm and actually wants to take up her own position in the world.
Well, Charles, you're going to pick up, I think, that theme of that feisty young cello that you've got there in your arms and use it to give us a piece that symbolises some of the happiness that emerges in that part of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And there's a particular piece, I think, that you've chosen to try and illustrate that sort of happiness.
Yes, it's another rumbustious piece. It's by W.H. Squire, it's a tarantella, and it's strange because it's a very happy piece, but it's in a minor key, very unusual.
Tarantella has a sort of appropriateness because although it's a rambunctious piece, it also is actually a dance of death. And we do have to remember that unfortunately, it's part of the plot, of course, Mr. Chips's story does not end happily. His wife and child do die during the proceedings. And that sense of tragedy linked with the cello has also been seen in much more contemporary history. Between 1992 and 1995, of course, the city of Sarajevo in Bosnia was besieged. And a recent novel, Stephen Galloway's The Cellist of Sarajevo, used that instrument to symbolize a much wider range of emotions in a story that was actually set during the siege itself.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is supposed to be based on a true story, recounting events that happened in 1992. And the story is that this cellist, who actually was a professional cellist and worked at the opera house in Sarajevo, was at his window when he sees a mortar shell fall on a queue of people waiting to buy bread. And 22 people are killed. And so he takes his cello downstairs. It's this portability of the cello, again, that becomes so important here. And he decides to play. Then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 24 hours after the mortar fell on his friends and neighbors while they waited to buy bread, he will bend down and pick up his bow. He will carry his cello and stool down the narrow flight of stairs to the empty street. The war will go on around him as he sits in the small crater left at the mortar's point of impact. He'll play Albinoni's Adagio. He'll do this every day for 22 days, a day for each person killed, or at least he'll try. He won't be sure he will survive.
And again, if we think about the links to the most tragic and melancholy moments of the 20th century, one can't help but think of the teams of musicians, often string quartets and trios, that played in Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War.
Exactly. I have to say, a friend of mine knew one of them, and when she was a child, was always fascinated by the tattoo on her arm. And it is, you know, it is the melancholy sound of the cello that most poignantly and vividly evokes those difficulties, and in some ways ameliorates them, and in some ways makes a contrast which is actually, you know, even more painful, because the to have that beauty injected into a scene of such horror means that the cello is the instrument for that purpose.
So perhaps the cello as the soundtrack of the more disturbing parts of 20th century modernity.
In many ways, yes, I think that's absolutely right. I remember once a critic saying to me, of course, this is why, after the Second World War, it was the low voices that people wanted to hear. You know, it was Kathleen Ferrier, it was Vera Lynn, it was the low voices that people needed, because it was the voice of comfort, the voice of the mother. And that, in a way, exactly parallels this huge fashion for the cello.
I'm afraid we have to end the conversation here, but it has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much to my guests, Peggy Reynolds, Charles Martin, and Helen Crayford.
And that Proms Plus literary event was presented by Rana Mitter. The producer was Georgia Mann. And in next Tuesday night's Proms Plus literary event, Mark Ravenhill will be talking about the myth of Faust, one which has fascinated writers for centuries, with Matthew Sweet. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, live here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Tom Service. We're going to hear a much belated prom's first. The first time in 117 seasons that one of the most original masterpieces of late 19th century music has been heard in full here. Bedřich Smetana's cycle of six tone poems, Ma Flast. Now, the most famous section of Ma Flast has been heard here rather a lot. No surprise given the brilliance of that fantastic fluid tune in the second tone poem, Voltava. I won't sing it for you now, but you'll recognise it immediately after about 15 minutes of the second half of tonight's concert. That's Smetana's evocation of the great river that flows through Prague, the Voltava. But there's much more to Ma Flast, my country, as you'd expect from a work that depicts the entire Czech nation in sound, its history, its battles, its spirit of independence, its myths, legends, and landscapes. It's music that's part of the beating musical heart of tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek.
In the Second World War, in the time of occupation by German Nazis in Prague, the piece has been banned. And for instance, Mr. Václav Talich, who was at that time the music director of Czech Philharmonic, the Nazis has tried to bribe him and to get support from him, which he refused always. And one of this attempt was that he was invited with the orchestra to Berlin. And he did agree because it was probably impossible not to agree, but he had the condition that they will play Smetana's My Country. And it had the consequence that afterwards the authorities, they had to allow to be played it in Prague as well when it has been played in Berlin. So that was one of the moments when the piece has been very much regarded as a big support of the resistance and of the self-esteem of the nation and the belief that the better time will come again.
Tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek. Ma Flast, then, a piece absolutely at the centre of the Czech nation's identity. Well, Ma Flast begins with a mythic bardic sound, four harps, music that's a monumental evocation of the Vyšehrad, a castle on the Vltava River near Prague. And we'll hear that tune again at the crowning moments of the very final tone poem tonight, Glánik. But before then, there's that marvellous melody that starts the second piece, Vltava. Then comes the bloody matriarchal drama of the third section called Šárka, in which the heroine, Šárka, takes terrible vengeance on men, all men, for their infidelities, and a huge technicolour massacre in the orchestra. The fourth section, from Bohemia's Woods and Fields, I won't try that in Czech, starts with one of the most dazzling bits of orchestral colour ever written. A shimmering fresco for the full orchestra that's like walking through a lush Central European forest in dramatic sunlight. An absolutely, absolutely indelible moment. Then comes the two interlinked final sections, Dábor and Blanik, two battles that end, respectively, in inglorious defeat and then glorious victory. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Andrew Havron, who's on stage already as they tune up, much expanded for this first full performance of Ma Flast. There are four of each of the woodwind players, there are more strings than usual, and four harps, where the score only really calls for two. So this is going to be a full surround sound performance of Ma Flast tonight. Jiří Bělohlávek was talking about the sense of Ma Flast being important in the 20th century for Czech identity, for Czech people. That's been true more recently too. In 1990, just after being freed from the Soviet yoke, Rafael Kubelik, the conductor, returned to Prague to conduct an unforgettable performance at the Prague Spring Festival of Ma Flast. So it's a piece that's symbolic of Czech identity throughout the whole, ever since its composition, and ever since its first performance in Prague in 1882. Well, here comes then tonight's conductor, Jiří Bělohlávek, to conduct the music of his homeland, Ma Flast.